And aren't you going to mark that?
This one's marked.
Oh,
I marked it during.
Excuse me. I don't run you, but no, I stew about that problem. I tell myself sometimes, after all, I'm a stockholder, that I ought to go down to management and just tell them what the hell's going on. In my opinion, is going on. I made such a pitch to management in 1963. That's a story that's never been published. And that's a dilly. I spelled all this out. There was, in the beginning, there was one cash register at Dow. That was up in the main office that was run by H.H. Dow and E.W. Bennett. And caustic supported styrene and polystyrene, no question about it. And Saran and Ethylcell. And as long as the total profits were good, fine. But when they broke up into 50 cash registers, and each one had to make a profit, that was the end. And I don't think you can cure modern management of that habit. Dow is coming up with new products all the time in the research lab. But they take it to management. They do a market survey right away. There's no market for that. It's not Dow, it's DuPont, it's ICI, it's everybody. So I think it's hopeless.
I had read recently, I think in Business Week, that the old Dow style was to create a new molecule and then go out to the marketplace to find a potential use. In this article, it says the new Dow does not have development of new products take place in a vacuum, but listens to what customers want, and then comes back to research. Does that make any sense? Is that
no? Anything that's said by any member of management for publication, that guy doesn't know his ass from a hole in the ground about research. Now, I've seen it happen. Research people don't get to talk to somebody from Business Week. So, and the guys at top management, they're isolated from middle management about the facts of life. So I'm pretty... feel pretty strongly about it, and the record shows that no new products are coming out. It's much easier to buy a successful business and add it as an increment to your operation. You don't make many mistakes that way. I was responsible for Dow losing, I'd say, $1 million on radiation chemistry as the way of the future. I was 100% wrong. But in those days, Dow permitted people to make mistakes, and people did make mistakes. I wasn't the only one who lost such money. That's the spirit that's gone. Nobody told Dow, well, I've told the styrene story, styrene monomer story in that Seymour article, but You look at something tremendously successful at Dow, like latex for paints and paper coatings and rug backing and all that sort of thing. Dow really pioneered that thing. And it was a... I told a story. The research people came up with this sequential polymerization of styrene and butadiene. It looked like a good cable insulator. Dow got money to build a plant during the wartime, and by the time the plant was built and running, polyethylene came along. So that plant was idle. And some chemists said, well, let's make some latex products in it. Not sequential polymerization, copolymerization, but styrene butadiene. And they did that. And someone discovered that, well, hell, these copolymers in the right composition range, not styrene butadiene rubber range, but up around 40% styrene or more, were film forming and gave tough, strong films. And that was paper. That was paint. Styrene butadiene latex paint. Started right here in Midland as a non-planned sequence. No customer told anybody what to do there. But once the chemists, the creative chemists, realized that here was an interesting phenomenon, the Dow went to Glidden, and the two of them together put latex paint on the market. So any management guy tells me that was doing what a customer wanted. That gets you small things. I know damn well that GE came to us at one point when their Norel was new, and they wanted a special impact polystyrene to toughen Norel. Dow management said to them, we can't be bothered, that's small potatoes, and turn them down. And another company in New England accepted the challenge, and it turned out to be £100 million a year business. So I lived through these things, and a statement like that one, it's bullshit. Pardon my...
No, I wanted your reaction to it, because I had some suspects about it myself, but...
I think maybe 3M operates maybe a little bit more along that style, because they're tailoring products to specific end needs, but that's not what made Dow big.
But if you tailor products to what the customer wants, you're really making more... a modification of something that exists rather than moving into something that's totally new.
Sure, but in this case of GE, that turned out to be... nobody could have anticipated that Norel was to be an engineering polymer of almost preference, that and polycarbonate. And so $100 million of something we could do as well as or maybe better than anybody else... Mm-hmm. Middle management guy says, we're going after the big customers. We don't want any of this kid stuff. And, of course, antagonized General Electric.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a, it's a sad story.
You made the comment, I think, in the Seymour article, that there were numerous irreversible changes at Dow between 1935 and 1963. Care to comment on that?
Well, I think I...
That
just,
in keeping with what we've just been talking about?
I think the... the two changes that had the biggest effect... a single cash register up until about 1965, and finding that internal competition was too expensive. Our going from a single cash register to multiple cash registers, the so-called profit centers. That was a serious blow. And then the lack of planned internal competition, sponsored internal competition, on the grounds of economy and the profit centers and so on. Oh, I guess I'm starting to heat up here. I better watch myself.
Around 1969, I guess there was another reorganization. You became director of the U.S. Area of Research and Development in Polymer Science. Was that the title? Was that part of another reorganization?
That was window dressing.
I see.
I was being kicked upstairs. Tell anybody who listens. It's a high-sounding title that is totally meaningless. The Young Turks were taking over, and they didn't like my style of management, of research. And I didn't care to adopt what the new style was. The new style is knowing every fact there is to know about any given project, having it on instant tap so you can tell your manager about it. So this is management. You know everything. And management says, gee, this guy's good. He's right on top of everything. That, I'm afraid, in my experience, is not where success lies. But there was this large group of young fellows who could and did do that. I didn't. That's not my style. Oscar Wilde once defined a critic as a guy who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. I don't know if you ever heard that one.
No, it's very appropriate.
But that's one I hadn't thought of that particular analogy before, but it's true. And the fellow who appointed me to this high-sounding position was Julius Johnson. I don't know if you run into that name at all. Well, he succeeded Bounty as vice president for R&D. And he was a guy that didn't know what research was all about. But he had conducted the market development on Tordon and other chemicals like that got used in Vietnam, and now was minting money from them like crazy.
What was his background?
He's a biochemist.
Biochemist.
Studied under Rose at Illinois. Damn competent man, but he had never been on the firing line in research. Well, anyway, so shortly after he got me out there to work with him and give me this high-sounding title, he got booted out as director of research. Mm-hmm. When the Texans took over, and they realized he didn't know A from whatever about actual research. And he was through. He got put on the shelf, too. So,
in 72, you became the first Dow research fellow. What did that entail?
Well, Well, it was a nice honor. And judging from people who eventually got appointed to the same thing, it's a select group of now, and I was certainly honored by it. It was a newly created way of doing something for people whose career had been in research. I'm pleased about it.
Did that give you more opportunity to continue some research work, or?
Didn't mean anything.
I see.
It was a title.
And then you came to MMI in
75.
75.
Yeah.
Judging from your list of publications, that's where a lot of your research interests started to bear fruit, because you certainly...
Yeah. Yeah, but I think it's sort of like striking a mother lode in a gold mine. Because here was, well, this simple idea that the expert said was wrong, Florey in particular, but he had lots of company, and when you have a whole field to yourself anymore, it's a little unusual.
Mm-hmm.
I still have my fingers crossed how right I was about it and so on, but I'm gaining more confidence as time goes on. And of course, I will want out once the, well, what to call them, the real polymer experts take over. I don't say that in any derogatory fashion. It's I don't know if you've ever heard the anecdote, I can't put names to it or say anything, about a college professor who was looking for postdocs or even graduate students, I guess it was. Could be either one. And one of his colleagues at another school said, I recommend so-and-so because when he says something about a project, that's the last word on that project. And the professor answered back, I'm looking for somebody who can say the first word. And I'm sure you've heard this concept. And I think I would have to say that my whole career has been largely in saying the first word on something. And then the experts take over, and that's fine. That's the way it should be. And they say the last word. So I think this apparent success here at MMI, I hope it's real with all these publications and so on. I've just had a field day at being able to say the first word, and that made it easy.
On several occasions, you were invited to lecture at the Soviet and Polish Academy of Sciences. How did these invitations originate?
Well, Well, we, my wife and I would go to the UPAC meetings for the Polymer Group, and we got to meet the international community quite well. And we very, very gradually struck up a feeling, I think, of mutual trust with some of the Soviet scientists, leading ones in the Polymer field. And the initiative for visits came from them. I went to a UPAC meeting in Moscow in 1960. But this later phase started certainly while I was still at Dow and could afford to go to all these meetings in the late 60s and early 70s. And
is there any one person that was instrumental in getting you these invitations?
Well, I think it was Plate at Moscow University. P-L-A-T-E with the accent over. First name is Nikolai. He was sort of the Well, he was one of the several heirs to Kargin in the Soviet Union, and but he was the perhaps the more personable and outgoing and gregarious of some of the others, and the language ability too. But I think one has to recognize that those people were over here looking for invitations, and I'm sure that I was a conduit to a lot of that. I never lost sight of that, because the CIA was after me after any trip abroad. I'd have a session, a visit, and I'd get pumped. So one had to assume it was going on both sides. Anyway, we my wife, she's a very